From the beautiful campus of Texas A&M University, the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology brings you the Sports Medicine Podcast. Our mission is to make sense of and connect the science, practice, and application of the latest findings in sports medicine and human performance to the real world. Here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance weekly podcast. Every week we bring you leaders in the field of sports medicine and human performance and find out what's on their mind. And today is no exception. We are quite honored to have Dr. Stephen Krause here. Dr. Krause is a professor here at Texas A&M. He's a fellow of the American College of Sports Medicine. He's the director of our Applied Exercise Science Lab and our Fit Life Exercise Program. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Tim. Glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. Let me tell the folks a little bit about your background. He got his PhD from the University of New Mexico in exercise physiology, and he's certified as a program director through the American College of Sports Medicine, and that's the highest certification you can have. So that basically means he's qualified to run cardiac rehab, pulmonary rehab, and a variety of other kinds of rehab programs. Well, I've asked Steve here today to talk to us about sudden death in athletes. There have been a couple of sudden death in athletes recently in the news. In the early part of December, an Oregon State football player died while he's playing pickup basketball. In the later parts of November, an Arkansas football player died in his dorm room, evidently playing video games, and both of these were diagnosed with cardiac myopathies. And that's all very scary, especially when we think about exercise and the number of people exercising. Is it common for people, athletes, let's start with athletes. Is it common for athletes to die during exercise?
Well, Tim, I think it's evident from anybody who watches sports that there are millions of sports participants in the USA, and the number of people who actually die during sport participation is relatively rare. And, you know, in terms of the number of actual people, at AHA, American Heart Association, estimates that there's probably one in 200,000. And there's other estimates that suggest in NCAA, a recent study suggested there's more like one in 43,770 per year. So the risk is very, very small. And yet we tend to overemphasize that. It gets, I guess, amplified by the press and by the very nature of the well-known athlete who suddenly collapses or something like that. And
well, it's something you don't expect, so it really gets suppressed, doesn't
very,
it?
Very much so, because we all think of athletes as, you know, being as healthy as you can possibly be, being active. Of course, we know that exercise is good for you, so we're not trying to discourage people from being active. It's just a matter of there are conditions that do predispose someone to have a fatal experience during exercise, and certainly those are the things we need to try to identify.
Yeah, well, help us understand a little bit about this cardiac myopathy thing, cardiomyopathy, that in both of these cases there was supposedly underlying cardiac myopathy. What does that mean? That's a pretty scary word.
Yeah, it's a typical medical terminology, right? We got to give something a big name that sounds kind of scary. The number one cause of death in athletes, sports athletes, is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and that, of course, is a bigger word yet, and what it simply means is cardiomyopathy has to do with a disease of the heart muscle, myocardium. And so it's a big word. It simply means you got something going on with that myocardium, the heart muscle. That's a pathology, something not good, a disease. Hypertrophic has to do with the fact that this is a disease that's caused an enlargement of that heart muscle, an enlargement that isn't training related. And we'll talk a little bit about athlete's heart maybe in a little bit, because that's part of the problem is what is training due to the heart compared to what is disease due to the heart, and differentiating those.
Well, let's start with that. That's a good place to start. So when these folks train, when athletes train, their skeletal muscles get bigger. We expect to see bigger biceps and so forth. But you're also saying that their heart muscle also gets bigger as well.
Absolutely. We have done a couple of studies over the years that looked at that. And if I might just diverge a little bit, we did an interesting piece of work several years ago now. We published that. We looked at ultrasound echocardiography of heart muscle of women athletes throughout their basketball season. So we actually started with these women, Texas A&M women, in the early season as they came in, followed them through the winter, and then again did ultrasounds on them in the spring. And then, interestingly enough, the women that came back the next fall after their off season, we did ultrasounds again. And so we were able to essentially track what happened to the athlete's heart muscle as they participated in their sport with ultrasound, which allows you to image the heart muscle using sound waves. And so you can actually measure how big the heart is, how thick the heart muscle is, how big the cavities of the heart, the atrium and the ventricles, and how much space they actually, and how much blood they can pump. So what we found was, as you might guess, and this has been published in other athletes as well, is when you train your heart muscle, depending on the type of training, I might add, if you're doing more endurance training, the heart, the premium is on pumping lots of volume, so the size of the cavities, the ventricle tends to get bigger, so you can pump more blood per beat.
Right.
And then if you're doing a lot of heavy resistance exercise, weightlifting, for instance, where you're really exerting a lot of force and driving blood pressure up a lot, that tends to cause the heart muscle to get thicker. Kind of like if you might imagine, the more pressure you have to develop when you pump your blood, the thicker the muscle has to get. It responds just like you said with skeletal muscle. Cardiac muscle is striated muscle, so when it gets trained, it gets bigger. So the point is, you can get an increased heart size with training. And what we documented with these women athletes, that indeed, as you might guess, as they went through their training season from preseason to midseason to postseason, they got an increase in the size of the ventricle. In other words, how much blood could be was in the heart during each beat, how much blood the heart could pump with each beat, that increased dramatically. The size of the heart muscle itself increased almost 20-some%.
Wow.
Now, interestingly enough, then, after the season, when the women came back the next fall during their off season, even though these women tip fairly active, they're not just couch potatoes, the heart went back towards its pre-trained size.
Cool.
So very clearly then, depending on the kind of exercise, you can get an increase in the heart muscle thickness. You can get an increase in the heart, the size of the chambers in the heart. And all that is an adaptive response. It's normal to exercise. It's healthy.
So the heart's really, as we would say, plastic. It changes. It'll increase in size and thickness with exercise, and then it will decrease if you stop
Absolutely.
Exercise,
just right? Like your skeletal muscle is, that's a fantastic analogy, because if you train your bicep and you lift weights and you exercise, it tends to get bigger. It gets more able to exercise, so you can increase your endurance. Heart muscle does the same thing.
That's just like your bicep and my bicep that are massive.
Massive. Well,
of course, this is recorded, so no one can see
Absolutely.
This. Absolutely. You can't check the veracity of our claims.
Yeah. I know. I'm comparing yours to mine. I think you're bigger than me, Tim.
Well, I don't know. So with training, so the hearts do get bigger naturally, and that appears to happen in most people, right?
That'd be true in athletes or non-athletes. A lot of studies have been done in more recreational athletes, not just participants in NCAA sports or whatever. But clearly, as you train, your heart muscle tends to get bigger and stronger. And so whether you're a well-trained athlete or whether you're a 45-year-old man who decides to start exercising, or a woman, and your heart's going to improve in its efficiency as well as its size.
So that's just normal.
Normal.
That's not harmful at all. So what's the difference between that and this hypertrophic cardiac myopathy that these athletes tend to
have? Well, the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is a genetic enlargement of the heart. It tends to be inherited. I'm not an expert in that area by any means, but the genetics of that has been clearly shown to be a genetic issue. And the heart muscle enlarges much like you would see in training, but it enlarges in a pathologic way. And interestingly enough, you also get heart enlargement with other pathologies like high blood pressure, for instance. You get enlarged heart. The enlargement there tends to be, even though it looks on ultrasound or echo much like the enlargement you would get with training, it tends to be more pathologic, more problems develop with that. And from my reading of the literature, nobody's exactly sure why that is, why the trained heart gets big like in response to training, and it seems to be still healthy, whereas in a disease like hypertension or this cardiomyopathy, this hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, the heart muscle tends to be, I guess we could think of it in terms of not being as healthy. It's more predisposed to have some arrhythmias that would cause fatalities.
So how do you pick that up? And you know, you're the great person to have here for this, because I think you're probably the only person that's published data on actually screening football players in particular preseason for cardiac issues. So how do we pick this up in athletes? Because I know both of these athletes that just recently passed away, they I think the term they use is undiscovered cardiac myopathy. So it's like, is the screening there? Can we pick this up?
Great question, Tim. And we were fortunate enough several years ago to start a little study with our football players here at Texas A&M, supported by the athletic training group and our strength and conditioning coaches. Mm-hmm. So we've been, I think it's probably been 5, maybe 6 years now, we've been, all the new incoming football players, new recruits, transfers, mm-hmm. have been tested in my laboratory doing exercise stress testing as well as resting and exercise electrocardiography. And so we published an article in Clinical Cardiology back in 2009 on some of the data we had up to that point. And all we were trying to do is document what the electrocardiograms, or sometimes called ECGs or EKGs, of course those are just electrical recordings of the heart muscle.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found was that when you look at, if you just look at the normal, what's thought of as being normal in terms of ECGs, we documented that 79% of the athletes demonstrated at least one abnormal ECG finding.
Hmm.
And so things like ventricular hypertrophy, which is sort of the training analogy to this hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. In other mm-hmm. words, hypertrophy just means the muscle gets bigger.
Right.
And so when these football athletes, we found that 79% of them had some kind of abnormal ECG finding, but 65% of them had what we would consider EKG indications that their heart muscle was enlarged compared to normal. We call that ventricular hypertrophy. They also had other things like some differences in the EKG wave that would be considered abnormal, like some sinus arrhythmias, some left atrial enlargement, something called early repolarization, which has to do with how the ventricle is repolarizing.
So 2/3 of the athletes that you saw basically had some kind of electrocardiogram problem that if they were normal people and the cardiologist saw this, they would say, wait a minute, there's a problem here.
Well, actually more than that, about a little over three quarters of the athletes had at least one EKG sign of an abnormal EKG, all right? Mm. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean these guys have disease, obviously. And so here's part of the problem is just getting the database so that cardiologists and sport medicine practitioners can recognize the difference between a cardiomyopathy and just a training-induced hypertrophy. Because training mm-hmm. does induce hypertrophy and heart enlargement normally, and mm-hmm. that's healthy. Mm-hmm. But what is going on to cause this pathology is another question. And so being able to differentiate that really requires a lot more data, a lot more of these kinds of data being published to help sport medicine practitioners differentiate that. So, yeah, in terms of finding abnormal EKGs in football players, a high prevalence of that. Stanford study actually published just recently, Stanford Sport Medicine Center published some data just recently on that, and they found that in male athletes, not just football players, 62% had an abnormal EKG finding. Now, interestingly also, in our study, and the Stanford study only had 10% black athletes.
Mm-hmm.
In our study, we found that the black athletes demonstrated these abnormalities at a much higher rate than did the white athletes. So there does seem to be, in fact, in African-American athletes, there is 85% of those athletes had one abnormal finding, and in the Caucasian, it's white athletes, 65%.
So there's some
ethnic. There's definitely some ethnic relationship to this. And by the way, the sudden death in athletes is higher in African Americans as well.
Hmm.
So now why that is and what kind of changes are going on in the that's ethnically related, those things still are yet to be determined as far as I can tell from the literature.
Now, in the paper that you guys published in 2009, if I remember correctly, that while there was, as you said, there was 79% that had some kind of ECG abnormality. It was unsure if most of them would be dangerous or not.
Right.
But in particular, there was one case that the ECG abnormality was considered dangerous, and I think there was subsequent surgery.
Absolutely.
With
and
that individual.
Good point. And there was the heart, the three main causes of death in athletes, sudden death, is, as you've already mentioned, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is number one, some kind of coronary abnormality is the second one. The third one has to do usually with some kind of arrhythmia. If you might remember locally here, there was a young man just last fall that collapsed on the field, football player, was resuscitated, and he had a long QT syndrome, I think is what the final diagnosis was, which would have been picked up on an EKG, by the way.
Right.
Now, so this idea of this one athlete that we identified, which was very interesting, because the first year we got permission to start to study with the athletes, the very first person that we tested that fall was a young man who was a transfer student and had been playing junior college for a couple years. And I was putting on it, I was working with his EKG, and this is the kind of change he had on his electrocardiogram is one that you can find at rest. You don't have to exercise somebody.
Right.
And it essentially with the heart, there is typically, there's the only connection between the upper chambers, the atria, and the lower chambers, the ventricles, goes through the AV node, atrial ventricular node.
Kind of the intersection
exactly.
of the heart.
And
right.
so yeah. the way the heart beats is the beat starts in the upper chambers and then goes through the atrial ventricular node to the lower chambers. And that's the way the rhythm is maintained. With this Wolff-Parkinson-White, which is called a pre-excitation syndrome, there's another genetically piece of tissue that connects the upper chambers with the lower chambers. So the heart can be depolarized over two pathways instead of just one.
Mm.
Now, what that means is you can generate some very significant ventricular arrhythmias that can be fatal with that kind of a problem. Now, that will typically show up, although they're not always, but the majority of those can be detected on an EKG if you know what you're looking for. Short story of this is, this first day, first guy, the first EKG I looked at, I said, this looks like WPW, Wolff-Parkinson-White. And we got to talking to the young man and found out later that he had had some episodes during practice and things like that, not with us, but where he'd been before, where he had gotten dizzy and went and sat down, things like that. And yes, the treatment for that is to go in with a catheter and do an oblation, a burning of that extra pathway, and once that scar is over, then the heart typically beats normally, and that's the surgery this young man had, and after that he was fine. But that WPW, Wolff-Parkinson-White, is one of the primary causes of death in athletes, since if it's not discovered and not treated.
Right. So in reality, this first day, what a way to start a study.
Exactly.
You and I have done enough research that, you know, the first subject, you see something like that, you go, wow, what are we really going to find here?
But exactly.
Essentially, you may have saved that young man's life.
I think that's there's certainly a possibility of that, though we'll never know. But he was having symptoms, we found out later, that he didn't realize what they were, neither did the coaches, and until we really were able to evaluate the EKG, that showed up.
Yeah.
Now, there's only one of those in all the studies that we've done so far, but I will tell you, we also discovered one of those in another player a few years back in basketball.
So this is not, it's
quite uncommon in the population, and so you don't see it often, but when it is present, especially with athletes who are going out to exercise and exerting their heart at high levels, it can result in fatal arrhythmias.
Yeah. Now, we've talked about a couple different screening methods. We talked about doing an electrocardiogram or an ECG, and we've also talked about doing echocardiography or an ultrasound on someone. Are both of these screening methods currently used in most athletes?
The EKG is not typically endorsed as a part of the pre-participation physical exam in the USA.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe, it is, in most of Europe. And so it depends on where you are. And the question becomes one of, well, what can you get out of the EKG? And the other side of this is, it sounds like, since what we've described so far, that why wouldn't you want to do that? Well, one of the reasons you don't want to do that, it relates to what I've already said, is there's a lot of 79% of our football players had abnormal EKGs.
Right.
And by the way, we stress tested every one of those guys doing a maximal stress test. None of them had any problems, no arrhythmias, no passing out, nothing. So those EKG abnormalities, we would consider them abnormal if they were in a normal, untrained person, they didn't result in any significant problem during exercise. So, but if we were to take a look at those and say, well, wait a minute, you've got this ventricular hypertrophy by EKG, we need to send you now for ultrasound. Well, how much is that going to cost? Well, that also takes the athlete out of participation for a while. So there's the whole issue of what is known in the medical literature as false positives. Anytime you do a test, any kind of screening test, there you identify people who have the disease, and your test identifies them correctly. Then there are people that look like, according to the test, they had the disease, but in fact they don't have the disease. And in this case, that's called a false positive. Now, the problem is when you do ECG with football athletes, you have a lot of false positives relative to the number of true positives you pick up.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the estimates are anywhere from 2% to 16 to 17% of the tests that you'll do, if you pick up an abnormal test, will be what we call a false positive. In other words, it looks like the person had the disease, but when they go to these other more expensive tests and time out and all that, it proves not to be the case.
So I think, but I think those numbers bear repeating, maybe in a different, you said 2% to 16% would be false positive.
Right. Another study just recently published in 2010 showed that if you do a screening history and an examination, which is what the American Heart Association recommends, you do a screening, you do a history, and there's a series of questions they ask to try to get at whether or not somebody's had has a cardiac problem. Things like, have you passed out before? Any of your parents died young? Those kinds of questions that would at least get you some information about whether or not these athletes might have a disease, a cardiac disease that might lead to death.
Right, or the genetic predisposition.
Exactly.
It, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if you do that kind of exam, this study that was recently published in the Archives of Internal Medicine 2010 found that they identified 45.5% of the athletes tested that's called sensitivity. Okay. And that's the ability to rule in a problem. So in other words, this actually was an athlete that showed up on the screening test as having a disease, and when they went and checked them further, they really did have the disease.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we call, or I think about sensitivity, is the ability of the test to rule in disease.
Mm-hmm.
45.5% of those who turned up positive, well, the specificity, then the ability to rule out is another important component.
Right.
And that is, if the test is negative, does the person really not have the disease? That's called specificity, ruling out. That was 94.4%. All right, now when you add EKG to that evaluation, that goes to this ability to rule in disease went to 91%. Okay, but the specificity, the accuracy of ruling out disease, went up also to almost 17%.
Mm.
So if you add EKG, you do a good job of ruling in. Okay, mm-hmm, you detect mm-hmm. more people than you would otherwise. But you also rule in people or come up with these false positives that then have to be followed up. And so the expense becomes an economic question and comes into play. In the USA, this is where usually, from my reading anyway, comes down to an economic question. We have to therefore follow all these false positives up, and most of them are false positives. So the expense then becomes a big issue.
But in one sense, I guess, if I'm hearing you correctly, so we're letting money be the decider as to whether or not we do screening in our athletes?
Well, it gets down to that is certainly a part of the issue from my reading of the literature.
And I should say, especially ECG, because we really haven't talked about ultrasound.
Right, ultrasound is even more expensive. And by the way, we are collecting data for the last 4 years now. We have ultrasound data on all these athletes as well, which we will be publishing soon. But there's not a good data bank be able for sport medicine practitioners and clinicians to be able to evaluate what is a healthy training heart and what's an unhealthy one. So we still need more data on that, and we're trying to capture that, and we got some really good stuff going with that too. But the question is, really, what is the cost? Okay.
Right.
Well, recent estimates in terms of the economic cost is that if you have a 2% false positive, which is the lowest I've seen published in athletes, the cost estimate is about $22,000 per life year saved. Now, if you go with the American Heart estimate, which they are using older data that typically is less, suggests there's less problem than there really is, their false positive estimate is somewhere around 15%.
Right.
If you do the math that way, the cost estimate then is about $190,000 per life year saved.
So help me unpack those numbers, because I'm a little bit confused by those numbers since we've been doing math here. I'll say,
Don't make me do math in my head.
Yeah. So we're talking about we're actually saving $190,000 for every year.
No,
The
cost, if you consider the false positives, the cost of every life year you save is $190,000.
So for every person who we save because of this screening,
cost would be in the system. in the system, the cost estimate is 190. Now that's at today's dollars, and the assumptions are, you know, you get a false positive, and the typical kind of follow up that would require to pronounce that athlete is healthy.
So we're putting a cost on life.
We're putting a cost on life, no doubt about it, and people are looking carefully at that in athletic budgets. And if you think about, for instance, Italy requires EKG screening for all athletes, and they have for, I think, 27 years or so. Well, their population of athletes is like 6 million or something like that. Well, USA is 30 million plus when we start thinking about high school and screening for collegiate. And by the way, the pros, the NFL, and the International Olympic Committee do require or recommend EKG screening for their athletes.
So is it required? Or is it recommended?
It's in the professional football leagues.
Right.
I would be misspoken if I said required, but I know I don't know of any that don't do it.
And that's just ECG. That's just electrocardiograms. Right. That's not necessarily ultrasound. Does anyone require ultrasound?
Not that I know of. Okay, but again, I'd check on that for sure. But I don't know of any organization that requires ultrasound of their athlete.
Because I guess our audience should be clear that the electrocardiograms measure the electrical pathways of the
good
heart.
Point.
Which you can get a lot out of. You can understand a lot about how the heart functions with that, but also the ultrasound is actually the structural, where you can get a picture of the structure and the function of the structure. So there's really two different things that they're looking
Very
at.
Very good point, and I'm glad you brought that up for clarification. Yes, the ECG only looks at the electrical activity of the heart, and the interpretation of that electrical waveform allows you to make decisions about whether or not there's disease present.
Mm-hmm.
The ultrasound actually uses sound waves to image the heart muscle, and as you said, then you can look at actual structure and actual function of the ventricle. It is a lot more information than you can get just with the EKG, but also the cost and the expertise of the people to do that exam is exponentially higher than EKG.
If you had someone come to you, a parent that came to you and has maybe a high school athlete who maybe has passed out once or twice, and they say, you know, Dr. Krause, is it worth my money to go spend the money and have an ultrasound on my child and an ECG just to rule out potential problems down the road? Would that be a fair statement, or would that be a fair recommendation?
The recommendation is absolutely. If any athlete who might have any kind of fainting, dizziness spell. Now, again, we're talking about cardiac issues, and of course one can get dizziness and things like that from dehydration as well.
Sure.
So, but given an athlete who is experiencing some dizziness at high-intensity exercise, or maybe they can detect fluttering in their chest, or there's some other terms you can look at, you know, kind of a dizziness, a passing out for sure, then absolutely they need to have a cardiac work.
I guess my question, we have talked about recommended and required and so forth, and to some extent then we're waiting for the sanctioning bodies to say, you need to have this done. But on the other hand, it's almost a good recommendation for everybody to have it done for themselves.
Well, economically it would cost, but certainly in my opinion, at least getting that baseline and making sure everything's okay. And again, then you have the false positive issue, though I don't want to leave that part of this out because there's very wise physicians that run our national governing bodies in the USA that believe that we should not require EKG of all of our athletic in their screening evaluation. And so, but that's not to say they're not endorsing it as officially required, but they certainly aren't telling anybody you shouldn't do it.
Yeah. How much does it cost to have an ECG done?
Honestly,
just a ballpark.
You know, by the time you get the cardiologist to evaluate it, which you have to have, of course, if you went to the clinic, you'd probably be talking about a couple $100 at least, and I could be way underestimating that. But, you know, cardiology time and just running a resting EKG, simple to do. I mean, we do it all the time in my laboratory. And by the way, just as an aside, I might say that at A&M, they're very progressive and work with us a lot in that if any athlete has any kind of symptom during practice or in their normal everyday life, one of the first things they do is bring them into my lab, and we do a resting EKG, and we also do, if it warrants it, we'll do exercise stress testing. And then that information goes directly to the team cardiologists that are evaluating these people and really keeping close tabs on them. Our only research study right now is with the football team, but we certainly would be, you know, willing to work with other athletes as well.
Is that common around the country, or are we unique in that? Is our university unique in that?
I would Well, certainly referring to a cardiology group, if somebody's passing out on the field, I'm sure most athletic training D1 schools would be doing that. But in terms of having the resources like we do and the working relationship we do in our, with my lab and the athletic training group and the strength mm-hmm. and conditioning coaches, we're quite unique, I believe, in that really good relationship where they pick up the phone and call me and say, hey, I got this guy that had a problem in practice today. Can we bring him in tomorrow? And so, okay, let's get him in.
Cool.
And in matter of fact, we've got there are three athletes, football athletes, coming in early. They've graduated from high school. Recruits coming in for next year that are going to be testing next, actually this Thursday. Mm. So the new recruits coming in will be testing. And so the and again, part of our research study with football athletes, kind of keeping tabs on these guys as they come in. So
well, that's great. I hope more out there are doing that. But before we get away from here, we're kind of running short on time. I have to ask a question about general health. What is the risk of sudden death in a general population? I mean, we've been talking about athletes the whole time.
Well, the older you get, the higher the risk is during exercise, obviously. Now, the reason for death tends to change. The older we get, the more likely we have cardiovascular disease, and that starts to become the more the cause of death. The actual bottom line is it's more risky for you not to exercise and not to be active than it is to be active. As we kind of laughed a little earlier before we got on here that more people die in their sleep than they do during exercise, so should we not sleep? And
right.
Very good way of putting it, I think. And so,
I tried not sleeping in college.
Yeah,
that, and it didn't
I
work
know,
very
that's
well.
Not good. Yeah, you don't do too well in your exams and stuff like that. But there's absolutely irrefutable evidence that exercise and an active lifestyle is beneficial for your health in many, many ways. Not the least of which is to help you live healthier and be more. And so. My recommendation is, now what's the risk of death? There is a risk. Anytime you increase the heart rate, you increase your exertion, you increase the risk that you could die of a heart attack.
Right.
But the risk, if you're not exercising and not active and you're obese and all the other problems we have in the USA now, then that risk is much higher than if you get out there and exercise.
Yeah, so go exercise.
Right. Go get out. Go get busy. Do something.
So as I mentioned, we're kind of running out of time here. So do you have we always give our guest a opportunity to give us one last take-home message, the one thing that you want people, if they're going to remember nothing else, that they remember this thought.
Well, I think that the real take-home message, in my opinion right now in the USA, is we don't have enough data to make good clinical judgments about whether or not an athlete's heart is a training-induced change that's healthy, or whether there's some unhealthy element playing a role. And until we continue to build our databases, one of the studies I read recently suggested that we very much need a national call to have a research database that we could start to build to make judgments about these issues of health in athletes.
Well, so this is a continuing story.
It's a continuing story, continuing data collection.
That means we'll have to have you back in the future to tell
us
how the story is going.
How the story is progressing. Sounds good. Thank you so much, right. Tim, for the invitation. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, thanks, Steve, for being with us.
Dr. Lightfoot, don't forget about our new 2012 Health Finds T-shirt question. Be the first one to email in the answer, and you'll receive the new 2012 T-shirt. And the question is, what are the top three causes of sudden death in athletes?
And I want to thank everyone that's listening for taking the time to download us and listen to us. And you are certainly welcome to send us comments and questions if it's about the topic. We will certainly pass those on to Dr. Krause as well. We hope that you join us next week for another episode here of the Huffines Institute. We hope that you have an active and healthy week and that you'll join us next week.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Kelsey Sachs and Cheryl Marek and made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and to talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closing are provided by johnmilesproductions.com, providing voiceovers internationally. Music was provided by Dave Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.